Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for supporting the Tattered Cover. Most of you are here tonight because you've already read The Glass Castle, so there's very little I can tell you about Jeanette Walls that you don't already know. So in the way of an introduction, I'll talk instead a little bit about Half-Broke Horses, which you're here to hear about this evening. This is shelved in the fiction section and is classified as a novel, but it's actually an oral history written in the voice of Jeanette's maternal grandmother. Book list describes Lily Casey Smith as a fearless, progressive woman who will not be corralled. And the New York Times, in recommending Half-Broke Horses, refers to Lily's adrenaline-charged frontier background. We look forward to hearing Jeanette present her newest work, illuminating her compelling faith in humanity. Please welcome Jeanette Walls.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you all for coming out on this rather dreary night. I so much appreciate it. I'm so flattered and so honored. You know, it just gives me great joy to be talking to readers. And that's ironic because for so long my story was a source of shame for me. I will not be reading from Half-Broke Horses tonight. You guys look like a pretty literate crowd, and I figure y'all know how to read yourselves. So, I will tell you that my story was such a source of shame for me that there was no doubt in my mind that once people knew the truth about me that I was going to lose everything. So it's just made me realize what a knucklehead I've been for so much of my life. And what I'd like to do with our time together is first share with you some of the things that I've learned since the publication of The Glass Castle, and explain how that led directly to my decision to write Half-Broke Horses. One of the things that I learned is how much I underestimated people. As I said, I thought I was going to lose all my friends and I thought I was going to be fired from my job and lose whatever meager little standing I'd carved out for myself in the world. And I've never been so wrong. And the first lesson I learned is how much I underestimated people. Their goodness and their kindness and their willingness to root for a kid from the wrong side of the tracks, as long as I was willing to be honest. But I think more importantly, you know, I underestimated the degree to which everybody has something. And that has been the great gift that readers have given me in exchange for coming clean with my stories. You know, I can't tell you how many folks have come up and said, you know, the details of our lives are very different, but you and I have a lot in common. And they start telling me things about their lives. And sometimes they have rough Scrabble backgrounds like I did, but sometimes they were raised in great wealth. But maybe they had an alcoholic dad or a loopy mom or something. And they start telling me their stories. And sometimes they start crying and they say, I'm so ashamed. I've never told anybody this before. And I think, why would you be ashamed of that? That's such a great story. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I was ashamed too. And it's just been such an eye-opener for me and a real life changer about what happens when we tell our stories. When I was sitting down to write my story, I was thinking, why am I doing this? I have everything in the world I've ever wanted. I go on television and discuss important things like Jennifer Aniston's haircut. You know, and I have my name on a column. I live in a house with flush toilets. What more could anybody want from life? And then I developed a fantasy for my story, and that was that somebody... that a rich kid. I wanted students to read it, particularly a rich kid. What I used to call a rich kid, and that meaning somebody whose parents paid the bills on time. And that person would have a little bit more sympathy for kids who grew up like me. And then I worked on the book a little bit longer, and I developed an even fonder hope for it. And that was that somebody who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks would read it. And would get the same sense of hope that I got from reading A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And I have to say, as I was saying, I so underestimated people, and I hugely underestimated young readers. I see that we have a couple here today. Thank you so much for joining us. Just bear with me while I tell you just a little bit about the reaction to The Glass Castle that just stunned me. Not long after the publication of the book, a very attractive young woman came up to me. She looked 14 or 15. And she said, you know, there's this girl in my class, and she always wears these ugly, out-of-date clothes. And me and all the other cheerleaders make fun of her. She told me she'd read The Glass Castles while she was vacationing in the Caribbean. And she said, you know, she said, now I understand, and I will never make fun of her again. And I thought, the Lord can strike me down with lightning right now, because I have done my job on this planet. I made that one person understand. But then not long after that, a teacher told me that a young man who had never read a book cover to cover actually started carrying The Glass Castle around with him. And she said, I thought you don't like reading. He said, oh, I don't. She said, I thought you don't like books. He said, books are for nerds. And she said, but you like this one. Why is that? And this young man thinks for a second. He said, this here is a fine white trash story. And then the teacher added very quickly and a little bit nervously, I believe he meant that as a compliment. But I took it as a compliment. In fact, I think it is perhaps the greatest compliment I've ever received. Because if a young man who thinks of himself as trash can hear my story and say, hey, you know something? She's not that different from me. And then if a popular cheerleader hears it and says, hey, you know something? She's not that different from me. You know, to me, that's why we read and why we write. It's you know, we memoirs, I think we get a little bit of a bum rap. People think that we're exhibitionists and out there, like, showing off our traumas. But it's not that at all. It's saying, this is my life, and maybe you can learn something from it without the nasty business of actually having had to have gone through it. And if it sounds like I'm bragging up here, it's because I sort of am. But I'm not bragging about myself. What I'm bragging about is the power of storytelling. Because I think that people who read memoirs and biographies, it's not a freak show. They're looking to understand lives that are unlike their own, and maybe learn something about people in different circumstances from their own. And in doing that, the shocking thing is that we often learn a little bit something about ourselves. But we memoirs, we also have another dilemma. And that is that we got our one story, and then what do you do after that? You know, I sort of didn't want to write The Glass Castle. I tried a couple of times, and basically my husband hog-tied me to the desk. He said, you're going to write this thing. But so I was like, okay, and I thought I was going to sink like a stone, and that would be that. But instead, I started touring a lot on behalf of it. And one of the many things I've learned is how much smarter readers are than me. Really, readers have asked me such good and tough questions and pointed out nuances in my story that I didn't even recognize or realize. And time and time again, people would ask me, the questions I got more than any other were about my mother. People would say to me something along the lines of, your father, I understand. I understand alcoholism. Your mother's a mystery to me. Why would a woman with a college education, who had the wherewithal, the resources, to lead a somewhat normal life, why would she choose a life like that? And we would discuss details about my mother's childhood. And inevitably, their faces would light up with what my grandmother Lily would have called that eureka moment, when you understand something that had previously been inexplicable. You know, that's one of the reasons that I'm drawn to nonfiction, is because the answer is always there. If you're willing to dig deeply enough, the answer is there. But so we talk a little bit about Mom, and usually these conversations would end with the advice from the readers, your next book should be about your mother. And I resisted at first because I thought I'd sort of told Mom's story in The Glass Castle. My mother, by the way, in the end of The Glass Castle, y'all know, she'd been living in an abandoned building in Lower Manhattan for 15 years without heat and running water. And I'd been begging her to come live with me. And she kept on turning me down. Not live with me, because I'm not a saint, but we got a place out back. She can live in that. But she says, you know, I live in the abandoned building where she'd been living for 15 years. It caught on fire when she was back on the streets. And, you know, she says, I live in the most exciting city in the world. Why would I want to go live in the sticks? And I said, because you're living on the streets, Mom. And she said, I'm not a moocher. I'm not some charity case. And I said, you know, we're thinking of getting horses and we could really use the help. And she said, I'll be right there. And she moved in a couple of years ago, and it's been a real eye-opener. She's been sort of wonderful. My brother said, don't let her live with you. She'll bring her craziness and her homeless friends with her. And it's actually, it's been quite wonderful. And she's really surprised me. She's really quite good with the horses, except she's turned them loose a couple of times because she thinks they should be free. But other than that, she's been really good with them. But, you know, so people were proposing this idea about writing Mom's story, and I needed somebody to write about. I have no imagination. Sometimes I'm on panels with fiction authors, and they talk about their flights of fancy, and my fancy doesn't fly. It sort of burrows. It just sort of digs down and tries to find stuff out. And I couldn't make anything up, but so I proposed the idea to Mom. I have to say, Mom was pretty fabulous about the glass castle. I was really nervous what she would think about it, because there's some tough things about her in it, and she was really quite good about it. She didn't read it before publication. She said she had no interest in it. She only read it after it became a bestseller. She said, it must be pretty good. Other people like it, so I'll give it a shot. And she said there's a couple of things. She disagrees with my perspective, my take on it, but she's not, except... There's one scene in the glass castle. I won't talk too much about the glass castle. I'll get on to half-broke horses. But I can't tell how many folks have said, you know, your mom had me until the chocolate scene. So I said, when we kids were going hungrily, mom had chocolate. And so I was really nervous about what Mom would think of that particular scene. And she's never mentioned it, but she was furious about my description of her driving. Other than that, she's been pretty fine. But so when I proposed the idea of writing about her life, she was all for it. And I tried to interview a couple of other people about their lives. I was interested in somebody who grew up in the Depression and in the Second World War, because I think one of the reasons, and maybe somebody who grew up without indoor plumbing, because one of the things, I wanted to write about somebody who had a tough life. I love writing about folks who have tough lives. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do that is because so many people have said to me, you're so strong, you're so resilient, I could have never grown up the way you did without indoor plumbing, and you're such a miracle. And I appreciate the compliment, but it's bunk. Indoor plumbing, it's a luxury that we've only had for the last 100 years or so, when many people in many parts of the world still don't have it. And, you know, you just make do with what you have. And I wanted to write about a person in a time where that was sort of commonplace, especially somebody who moved into the time when people started getting indoor plumbing. So I really wanted somebody from the early 20th century. But Mom was all for the idea of my doing her story. And I interviewed her every single day for about a year. And she was fabulous. Not one time did she say, oh, this is too private, this is personal, don't go there. But what she did keep on saying during the interview is, this book should not be about me, this should be about my mother. My mother's the one who led the really interesting life. My mother's mother, Lily Casey Smith, was born in 1901 in a dugout. I told some folks that, there's some kids in the audience, and they said, oh, on a baseball field? No, on the riverbank, a dried up river. But, you know, she was, she broke horses, she started in training breaking horses when she was 5 years old. Her father trained carriage horses, but he was crippled. So my grandmother Lily had to do most of the actual physical work. She helped run his ranch. She became a school teacher when she was 15 years old, before she had a high school diploma. She worked very hard to get her high school diploma and ultimately her college diploma. She ran rum at some point. She was a school teacher mostly. That's what she truly loved. You know, this is just a very iron-willed woman who just loved to tame the land and tame all the critters in it and tame all the human beings in it. And she fell in love with the modern world. You know, she was around when electricity came and when cars came and airplanes came. She just fell in love with the future. And the future didn't always love her, but she was a scrapper. You know, she was a tough old broad. And I say that with great affection. She was a tough old broad. And, you know, one of my hopes for this story is that all of these people who think that they're not as tough as me, and, you know, again, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm complimenting myself, calling myself tough, but I'm a big fan of storytelling. I think we all come from a line of tough old broads and tough old coots, you know? All of our ancestors who came over to this country to get away from the potato famine or get away from the Nazis or over on slave ships or whatever, you know, a lot of hard work had to be done to tame the land. Just, you know, we didn't have indoor plumbing. You just did what needed to be done. And I hope that those of you who are good enough to read my story, that it causes you to reflect a little bit more on your own ancestry, to think about your own stories, your own story right now, and where you come from. Because I believe we're all made of really hardy stock. You know, we're all really resilient and really tough. Lily, one of her favorite sayings was, push and pray. She drove when she was teaching, she also drove the school bus, which was a hearse with the word school bus painted on the side, and it was all the time getting stuck in the mud, and so she'd have all the students get out and push it, and she'd say, push and pray, folks, push and pray, and they all had to recite Hail Marys while they were pushing it, and she always said, you gotta have faith in higher authority, but you also gotta bust your rump while you're at it, you know, and there's a book coming out that attacks the whole concept of positive thinking and saying you can't just wish for good things to happen. And I agree with that, but that's not positive thinking. That's wishful thinking. You know, those of us who are fans of positive thinking knows that positive thinking has got to come along with a lot of elbow grease, too. And, you know, Lily, in some ways, she was an incredible woman, but in another way, she was very ordinary. She was just a woman trying to make ends meet, trying to better herself. Oh, hello. The book was called... has been compared to Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's been called Laura Ingalls Wilder for adults. And I love that comparison because I love the Laura Ingalls Wilder series. You know, and my husband never read it. And he said, well, what did you love about it? And I said, well, I remember there was one scene where paw sand at the floor so clean you could walk on it in your bare feet. And I love the details, like what life was like back then. You know, as I was interviewing Mom, and she kept on urging me to write about Lily's story, and I didn't have the details, so I resisted it. And I was going to write Mom's story just as the backstory. And when I sat down to tell the story, I found that Lily's story, the backstory, was outweighing Mom's story. I also found it much easier to get inside Lily's head than I found it to get inside my mother's head. My mother always told me when I was growing up, you're just like your mother, you know, and I don't think she meant that as a compliment. She's just like my mother, rather. And she didn't mean that as a compliment. She did not get along with her mother. And her mother was just somebody driven by rules. You got to improve things. And my mother is somebody who's driven by art and freedom and dancing and happiness in the sunlight. And, you know, we had to cut the weeds in front of her little, we call it a cottage, but we're putting on airs. It's a mobile home, but it has heat and running water. But we had to cut the weeds in front of her cottage, and she started crying. I said, what's wrong? And she goes, the weeds have a right to live just as much as the flowers. You know, and I understand the way Mom thinks, but when I was trying to write in her voice, it sounded like I was making fun of her. And when I wrote in my grandmother's voice, it just came to me, even though my grandmother died when I was 8 years old, I very vividly remember her. So I thought, I'll just go ahead and write Half-Broke Horses in Grandma's voice. And to do that, I found it easiest to write in first person. And whatever I didn't know, I just filled in the little gaps, the little fudged the details. And my intention was to change it into third person. But to qualify those little details that I didn't know, to qualify them with, you know, those tricks that historians do, like, it is believed what happened, or what is likely happened, or, you know, it is probable she shaded her eyes against the sun. But I showed an early version to my agent and editor, and they said, don't change a thing. Just leave it as it is. So in my mind, I very solidly crossed the line from nonfiction into fiction, because once you start making up little details, and the fact it's written in first person by somebody who's been dead for 40 years, so we're calling it a true life novel. And we're calling it fiction, though I love Gwen's description. It's an oral history. That's all it is. It's a story that was handed down, as I'm sure that all of y'all have from your moms and great, your grandmas and grandpas. And if you were to sit down and write those stories, you couldn't very well say, this is all absolutely true, because there's no written record. But, you know, as I said, I have become a big fan of telling these stories and passing them on. And learning from our ancestors, learning from where we came from, you know. You don't have to be tied down by the past, but it does shape who you are, and it's just fascinating to see the patterns and to see why you are the way you are. You know, while I was interviewing Mom one day, she was in a really good mood one day, and my mom, she's the eternal optimist. One time I was telling her she needed to straighten out her life and organize things. And she said, Jeanette, you worry too much. She said, things usually work out in the end. And I said, Mom, what if they don't? She said, that just means you haven't reached the end yet. You know, she's just somebody who just always sees the positive. But this one day she was in such a good mood. I said, Mom, why are you in such a good mood? She said, the most wonderful thing happened today. I said, what's that? And she said, I fell off a horse. Now, I said, Mom, how could even you think, you know, I know you can put the positive spin on absolutely anything, but how can falling off a horse possibly be a good thing? And she said, Jeanette, any fool can ride, but knowing how to fall takes great talent. And I thought about that comment a lot because I think there's a lot of wisdom in it, you know? When times are good, we can all just mosey on along. It's that tough time, you know, when we fall on our rumps, and we all fall on our rump from time to time. It happens to the best of us. And there's no shame in that. The shame is thinking that you don't have what it takes to get back up and ride on. And you know, and I talked to Mom a lot about that comment, and it came straight from her mother. Her mother, who broke a bunch of horses but got thrown plenty of times, and just very strongly believed that you got to just get back up in the saddle, you just ride on. And I think it's a good philosophy in life. And, you know, the thing is, if you get a little scarred and a little battered in your fall, that's okay too. You know, there's no shame in that either. That's something it took me a while to understand. I hope this next thing doesn't embarrass you guys and fall in the category more than you want to know about me, but probably crossed that line a while ago. But when I was dating the man who sort of became my current husband, John, he was raised sort of upper middle class. His father was a diplomat. He was raised overseas and went to fancy boarding schools and stuff. And I thought, you know, gosh, once he finds out about my past, he's just going to drop me like a hot potato. So we'd been going out for a little while, and I said to him, you know, John, there's some things you need to know about me. When I was a little girl, I got in a fire, and my dress caught on fire, and I had to go to the hospital and get these skin grafts. And he said, what are you trying to tell me? And I said, well, I've got some nasty scars. He said, why are you telling me all this? I said, well, don't want you buying a pig and a poke, you know, I'm sort of damaged goods here. And he said, you're apologizing? He said, oh, no, no, don't ever apologize for your scars. He said, those scars are a sign that you've survived and that you are stronger than whatever it was that tried to hurt you. I said, I just wish I was nice and smooth like everybody else. And he said, oh, no, 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 smooth is boring. You've got texture. Texture's interesting. I thought that was just about the smartest thing anybody had ever told me until I was addressing a group of readers. And I think I heard something even wiser. I told that story about wanting to be nice and smooth. And this woman came up to me afterwards, this incredibly elegant, well-dressed woman with big old diamonds flashing on her hands and hair all perfectly coiffed. And she, sweetie, come here. She said, there is no such thing as smooth. She said, you look close enough, silk's got texture. So, you know, so that's my message to you all. You know, we all have our texture. We all have our little scars. Some are visible, some are invisible, some are on the inside. There are stories, you know, and that's my new campaign is I want everybody to tell their stories. You know, you don't have to try to sell it. You don't have to write it down. You don't even have to show it to anybody, but I highly recommend that you do. Just think about your stories and think about your ancestry. And if you're lucky enough to have any ancestors around, to talk to them about the stories and actually put some of it down in writing for generations to come. Because we all have our texture, our stories. And just don't make the same mistake that I made for so long. And think that texture, that those stories makes you any less of a person. It's what makes you as strong and wonderful as you are. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.